I certainly brought up that topic.
And
but
what?
It was clear that, and again, this goes to what happened to House Bill 3069 last session, it's clear that the primary motivation behind this proposal before you is twofold. One is to take the profit out of crime. Two, to make use of the proceeds from those forfeitures for law enforcement activity at the local level.
Well, so Mr. Fedenke, then your reading of the group is that the primary purpose is not to take the profit out of crime, but to
I wouldn't go that far. I would say that it's a twofold purpose. Again, the political background we're dealing with is a federal statute which up to now has allowed sharing of revenue with local governments from federal property seizures in drug cases. I believe that those forfeitures could continue under existing law. It is only that the proceeds from those forfeitures would not be shared with state and local governments under the new federal law.
Well, would it remove your objection? Let me just ask this way. If rather than being forfeited according to the scheme in House Bill 2282, these fruits were forfeited in such a way so that the profit went into the general fund and became part of a budgeting process which was somehow dedicated to law enforcement and then the work done indirectly, would that change your opposition?
We would rather not see it dedicated to law enforcement. As a practical matter, there would certainly be a great deal of political pressure on the Ways and Means Committee to see that those funds were used for law enforcement. But certainly, we believe even with that kind of a proviso that it would be a significant improvement over the procedures in the bill now.
Would it remove your objection, but deal with your
not entirely, but it would deal with the lion's share of it, Madam Chair.
Representative Minnis.
Mr. Fedenke, it seems to me that if we were to direct these monies to the general fund, that would be subject to greater pressure to increase the amount of forfeitures simply because the demand on the general fund is much greater. I don't know that we really would be achieving anything by doing what you're suggesting. In fact, broadening who gets the money, to me, seems to kind of make that pull that you're talking about, that demand on the forfeitures, stronger. The more interested have access to it.
Representative Minnis, Madam Chair, our feeling is that by having the direct link between the proceeds from specific forfeitures and the budgets of the local law enforcement agencies, it is a far greater temptation than it would be if they were subject to the normal budgeting process.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Mr. Fedenke, what's your understanding of what happens under this bill if either a seizure without a court order or a seizure with a court order ultimately turn out to be inaccurate, wrong? What's your understanding of what happens both to the property and to the jurisdiction that did the seizing?
Those procedures, I believe, are covered in sections 5, and it might help to have Mr. Shepherd up here. There are procedures which provide answers to the questions of what happens to the property and also what happens with regard to the issue of the award of attorney fees and other costs in the case.
Right. That's really my question.
And some of our amendments do go to those provisions.
Madam Chair, sure. Representative Clark, I think the section you're looking for may be section 9 on page 10, lines 15 through 29. Rather through 27. All right. And briefly, in the event that a claimant is successful in asserting a defense, the property will be returned to that claimant, and the claimant may recover attorney's fees if it appears that there was not reasonable suspicion to make the seizure in the first instance. so that the claimant then would recover their attorney's fees if, in effect, if the government acted unreasonably.
And Representative Clark, Madam Chair, we are offering an amendment which would change reasonable suspicion to probable cause and provide that if the finding of probable cause had taken place by a court prior to the time of seizure, and that were an error, that attorney fees, that the local government would not be liable for those attorney fees, but the state would be liable for those attorney fees. I'm sure we would all like the judge to personally be liable, but we're not going to be able to get away with that.
The reason I ask the question is because I'm aware of situations where a commercial landlord, for example, wants to assert a landlord's lien over contents of a commercial leasehold, and the advice I give to the commercial landlord is you better be real sure about that, because if you're not, not only do you get hit with attorney fees, but you get hit with conversion and possible punitive damages as well. And I'm struggling for a public policy rationale for treating this in some different way, and obviously you've got the drug thing and all like that, but do you have any comments about that, Mr. Shepherd? Is there any?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I'm not sure it is treated in a very different way in this respect. My advice to the police agency is if you don't have reasonable suspicion that property is subject to forfeiture, you better not seize it, because if you do, we're going to get stuck with the claimant's attorney's fees. So I'm going to give my law enforcement clients the same advice you give your landlord.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one additional point to the bill. Section 4 on page 5, subsection 5, beginning at lines 6 through 8, includes a provision which Mr. Shepherd outlined earlier in his presentation, which allows for the government to continue with a forfeiture proceeding where the property has been seized in violation of the Constitution. Again, we believe that this is inviting mischief on the part of the government. We believe that as a policy matter, if not as a constitutional matter, this body ought to prohibit the forfeiture of any property which has been seized unlawfully or in violation of the Constitution. To do otherwise will only encourage local law enforcement officials to seize property unlawfully and unconstitutionally, knowing that they will be able to get the proceeds, or that there's a good chance of getting the proceeds from that property, even though they may know at the time of the seizure that they don't have evidence for a criminal prosecution.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Okay. I want to push you a little bit on that. What you're trying to do, obviously, is encourage the law enforcement community to follow the rules. Is there any reason for punishing society, if I can phrase it that way, at that point, rather than turning around and punishing the offending police officer or agency? Why not use a sanction against the officer or agency? Get all those folks mad at me here, but why not do it that way as opposed to saying that you can't use the proceeds of the forfeiture?
That certainly would be an alternative scheme that we would be interested in pursuing.
Rather than go at it from an exclusionary rule kind of standpoint, go at it from a direct sanction. If that's what you're trying to stop, that's use the quickest distance.
We would certainly be interested in exploring any such mechanisms, Representative Clark. To our proposed amendment to that subsection would provide that the property would be released according to section 5, subsection 2. We believe that most property for which there was evidence that it had been involved in criminal activity, or which was, for example, controlled substances or the instrumentalities of criminal activity, would not be claimed by individuals, and in effect would probably have to be destroyed.
Representative Edmondson.
Mr. Fedanke, are you concerned at all if the proceeds are going to local law enforcement agencies or are dedicated for law enforcement purposes, that there might be some unintended incentive to let a drug transaction occur thereby converting non-asset type goods like drugs into assets like cash. In other words, knowing that the drugs are held on Monday but will be sold on Tuesday might unwittingly encourage the seizure of those assets after the transactions occurred, because then they would be convertible into public proceeds. Are you concerned about that at all?
Representative Evanson, Madam Chair, I, like most of us, ascribe the highest motives to our local law enforcement officials. I know many of them personally. I know them to be of very high character. Nevertheless, I believe, again, down the road, as local law enforcement agencies became more and more dependent on this mechanism as a source of revenue for their budgets, that such invitations would be noted by law enforcement professionals, and that this body would be encouraging such activity by passing this measure in its current form. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fedenke.
Chair, I trust we're going to hear from the law enforcement community on these.
Yes, I'm sure we're going to hear from the law enforcement community on these issues. I'm going to ask for everybody's indulgence and take a recess. We'll be reconvening at 3:30. We're in recess. We will come to order. And we have Brian Riley and Bill Juza on the sheet.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is William Juza. I'm city attorney of the city of Salem, and with me is Brian Riley, the chief of police of Salem. We're here on behalf of the city of Salem and are here to support the House Bill 2282 that is before you. I might indicate to you that the city of Salem was one of the first, if not the first city in Oregon to have a forfeiture ordinance. We've had ours since 1985. It was pretty much modeled, and give credit to Multnomah County, and we took a look at theirs and what they were doing and instituted the same procedures in the city of Salem. Since 1985, we've had some 200 or more cases. We've never had any problem with our ordinance. It's been challenged a couple times, but to no avail. It has been a significant tool that Chief Riley will speak to in our drug enforcement program in Salem. We like to think, at least in our area, that we have one of the finest drug enforcement programs in the state of Oregon. We were involved to some extent while the bill was being drafted. We were present at many of the meetings, and there was a number of accommodations made as the bill was put together. There are only two areas that we would draw your attention to. One is just you've already heard the fact that the ordinances throughout the state are now sort of in abeyance as a result of the recent Court of Appeals case. So we would urge you to consider attaching the emergency clause to the bill so that if it is passed, it would go into immediate effect and put us back where we were before the Court of Appeals case. The other amendment has to do with the provision in the bill that provides that an agreement shall be made between the forfeiting agency and the county, and if no agreement is forthcoming, the monies are frozen. We object to that provision. We think that that should be left to the local jurisdiction. We've had no particular problems in Marion County On occasion, we have shared forfeiture monies with the county when they have been involved in our enforcement program. It's my understanding, and you'll probably hear testimony in this regard, that there is such an agreement in Multnomah County that exists, and I think that is fine. Our point is that we believe it should be left to the local jurisdiction as to the priority set in the expenditure of the proceeds. In Salem's, by Salem's ordinance, all of our proceeds is delegated and earmarked for law enforcement. I think with that, I will let Chief Riley tell you about our program and how it works in Salem.
Brian Riley, Chief of Police in the City of Salem. First, let me tell you that I have made a major commitment to direct resources towards the enforcement and education as it relates to illegal substance abuse in my committee or in my community. I have 5 personnel that work full-time in narcotics, a sergeant, 3 officers, and an analyst, and we're assisted by an Oregon State Police officer in that assignment. Forfeiture funds pays for that analyst, and forfeiture funds pays for the canine dog that they use. In addition, I have a street crime squad of 6 officers that is used as a tactical deployment to address current problems in the community. Most of their time is spent in enforcement of street narcotics offenses, and the significant part of that is from direct input by the citizens in our community who says to us, we've got a problem. It's here in our neighborhood, and you can see the transactions going on. Prostitution has been directly related to that. The income in 1 calendar year from seizures and forfeitures to the City of Salem was $197,000, 87 and 88 fiscal year. My investigative fund just for my 5-member squad is $200,000. There's no profit in civil forfeiture to us. It's less than 2% of my budget. So I don't think you're going to see any great effort to go out and start seizing funds. We've been doing it already. We also have used these funds to pay for education by supporting Salem-Kaiser Youth Drug Awareness, by supporting Salem Youth Club, and by providing free to parents preparing for the Drug-Free Years Educational Opportunity Program. My major concern is that this is just one tool. Prosecution is the first and foremost tool that we use. This supplements the ability for us to deal with narcotics. We made 590 arrests in the City of Salem in 1988 for narcotic offenses. All of this is not aimed at possession. It's aimed at sales and distribution and manufacturing. We served 160 search warrants, and we recovered $2,204,000 in drugs from our streets. In 1987, there were 393 arrests. That's 200 arrest increase in 1 year. This epidemic, and I don't know of a better term to describe it, is going to get worse. The price of 1 gram of heroin has dropped from $300 to $160 in 1 year on the streets here. And cocaine has dropped from $110 to $80 a gram in 1 year. Because of our efforts in the adoption of 2282, we think it will provide an opportunity to have a jurisdictional-wide, throughout the state, forfeiture ordinance. And that opportunity is this. In 1987, 25% of our search warrants were outside of the city. In 1988, that's gone up to 38%. So we think our efforts are pushing, at least to some degree, drug dealers out of our community. House Bill 2282 will give us some consistency. I'd like also to speak in support of the amendment offered by Mr. Shepard. That is to place some limit on the cash amount. The area that gives us the most complaints from our community are street dealings. It is also the area that when you make an arrest after observations or the use of informants or the use of officers in making purchase, usually the recovery of forfeit funds is somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 to $800 on the average. The notification publication requirement will cost me $700. But I speak in support of that amendment to place that limitation in dealing with street narcotics. Because in Oregon, there's no jail time. All of our significant dealers we take to the federal system because they're not going to spend any time here in Oregon. So we urge your support.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Representative Clark.
Chief Riley, I don't know whether you heard me ask Mr. Fedanke a question about what to do when the law enforcement agency turns out to be wrong. The way the bill is currently written, there's sort of an exclusionary kind of rule that comes into play. Property which has been unconstitutionally seized, the way the ACLU would like it to read, may not be subject to forfeiture and must be released by the forfeiting agency. I guess my question is, how would you as a police chief feel if we did away with the exclusionary approach to that and gave some sort of limited sanction to the officer or officers who seize the property without, as it turns out, without probable cause? And my concern is that I don't understand why we should punish the society at large for the mistake of the police officer by excluding the forfeiture altogether.
I guess I'm not. I've been a police chief in Oregon for 15 years. And I have had cases where officers have been found to have made errors in judgment, but usually it's after a long court review process on appeal someplace, and it's a fine line.
Sure it is.
It's a judgment call. I would not want to place my officers at risk because in their efforts to serve, then they're going to be sanctioned if they make a mistake. They already face that sanction civilly now in their processes.
Well, except for that the whole theory behind an exclusionary approach is to punish the police officers that violate the Constitution. I mean, that's the whole theory. If we're going to create an incentive out there for these police officers to follow the Constitution, and this comes directly from the Warren Court, not from me, and the way we're going to do that is that if they screw up, we're not going to let them use the evidence. And that's been the theory of the exclusionary rule for
right.
25 years. Longer than that. There are those who've come along and said, that doesn't make any sense at all. You punish society at that point. You're not punishing the police officer. And I'm just asking, what if we tried that in a limited way here? I'm not interested in punishing police officers who are out there doing their best, but I am interested in shifting focus away from the evidence, or in this case, the property that's later on, you're right, four appeals down the road determined to have been seized unconstitutionally. Shifted away from invalidating the conviction, or in this case the forfeiture altogether, come back and say, okay, well, we're going to have a letter of reprimand to the specific officer so that you put the incentive where the incentive belongs, which is on the officers and not on the focus of the investigation or the activity.
Well, the investigation of narcotics is very complex. In all of the major cases, you always are dealing with legal advice. And almost without exception, you have search warrants before you ever complete that investigation, either through the federal system and or the state system. I would see this mainly come into play or the officer on the street who may make a car stop and or a response to a complaint and deal with somebody on a street corner they see dealing. And I would not want to put them to that extra degree of criticism or possible sanction beyond what they already have to deal with.
Okay.
Representative Minnis.
I don't really have a question, but I guess in response to Representative Clark's statement, I think it's interesting when we look at the law enforcement community, and it happens to be a bill in this session, by the way, that was sponsored by a representative from Southeast Portland, to deal with the issue you're talking about where an officer would violate, intentionally violate constitutional rights of an individual and allow the Board of Police Standards and Training to issue some kind of sanction against the police officer. But I think it's very important to recognize that it's easy in constitutional law in the application of search and seizure to err and not know you've erred. And I can direct you to a case, State versus Westland, where I was the arresting officer in Portland, and the Oregon Court of Appeals said that, in fact, I needed to have a search warrant to have tested a vial of cocaine. It was unprecedented. And subsequent to that, it goes to the Oregon Supreme Court, and they earned the Court of Appeals. And the question I'd have for you is, at what point do you discipline an officer for violating a constitutional provision because of the complexity of the issue?
And it's sending you to the legislature cruel and unusual.
So I don't think that the issue is, yeah, that's true. We can get into a whole lot of issues relevant to being a member of this assembly.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Representative Mannix.
Your concern with dealing with Section 10 and removing the requirement of an agreement with another political entity, say, or subdivision, and I can understand that concern. On the other hand, I have a letter from someone in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office begging me to make sure that that provision stays in because of the balance that they need to have. And apparently there's some dynamics here that may apply only to Multnomah County and the City of Portland. How would you feel about, instead of removing this language, as is suggested in Mr. Yuza's letter, you say page 10, lines 43 and 44, and page 11, lines 1 and 2, should be removed. How about limiting them to, say, a political subdivision which has a population of more than 300,000 people?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that's fine, obviously, with the City of Salem. I'm not so sure. I mentioned that to Mr. Bradley from Multnomah County. He wasn't quite as enthused about it. My point to him was that if Multnomah County, they handle civil forfeiture as well as, and Multnomah County handles the prosecution. And they have undoubtedly a tremendous cost factor and prosecutions of drug-oriented cases. In Salem, our office, the city attorney's office, handles all the civil forfeiture, and it is our police force. And so it's the local taxpayer that is fronting the civil forfeiture program. As on the prosecution end of it, actually, since we've been into the heavy drug enforcement, the prosecutions have dropped here in Marion County, so they actually have less prosecutions than they had before. So I guess direct answer to your question, Representative Mannix, we certainly support that.
Thank you.
Their testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ken Sherman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, which is a trade organization which includes all of the commercial and savings banks in Oregon. I'm also asked to tell you that my comments have the support of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association. I'm pleased to say, as we come before you today, that we strongly support the passage of House Bill 2282. We're convinced that civil forfeiture is a tool that needs to be added to the arsenal of our law enforcement agencies. As forfeiture ordinances have proliferated around the state, we've come to see very clearly the need for uniformity and certainty in this area, And we know that House Bill 2282 represents a great deal of work on the part of a lot of people, because I personally and many others representing the financial community have attended a great number of meetings over the last year, working with, at times, some difficulty to bring this from conceptual to the forum before you today. You might be wondering why the banking industry would have an interest in this issue, and there are a couple of fairly simple reasons. First, we've learned through experience that when forfeiture laws are applied, that financial institutions and other third parties, innocent third parties, frequently have security and other interests in the property which is being taken, and those interests need to be protected. Secondly, we believe that this new tool of civil forfeiture, as it is developed, it is critically important that there be uniform rules and procedures applied throughout the state. I think we now have something like 40 or 50 forfeiture ordinances around the state, and passage of this legislation will give every city and county throughout Oregon the framework within which to have civil forfeiture, both as to the types of prohibited conduct which are now identified within the bill, and also as to other conduct that the local governments might be concerned about. At the same time, though, it will give us the certainty that comes from uniform rules and procedures. The subject of forfeiture has generated a lot of interest during this session.